Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, by the ATVSwimSpas.com. You can check those out with Dave Scott at Ironman 70.3 Oceanside. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $80 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. By RunTheCity5K.com, coming up on June 15th in beautiful San Diego. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com, on iTunes, and definitely subscribe to our Endurance World newsletter. Our next guest, one of the premier coaches on the planet from Apex Coaching, the creator of Apex Coaching, Mr. Neil Henderson. Neil, how the heck are you?
I'm great, Bob. Great to be with you here.
Hey, thanks so much for taking time, Neil. First of all, we caught up the other day with the Leomo product over at the Velodrome. When were you first introduced to Leomo, and what were your first thoughts, and what are your thoughts now?
Yeah, the first, I think my first meeting with them was last summer, so summer of 2016. It was a busy time for me, getting ready for Rio and the Olympics, and I had actually kind of not answered some of the first emails or calls that I got from just kind of a cold call from
sure.
somebody with the company. And eventually, Ivan O'Gorman really nailed me down and said, listen, you should really talk to these guys. They've got some interesting stuff. So I was like, all right, I'll, you know, since I know you and you say that they've got something cool, something important to show me, then I'll make the time to do it. So last summer was the first time that I met with them, and again, it was a busy summer through Rio, and then once I got home, then we started talking more in earnest last fall.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I'm assuming that you get people all the time. Hey, I've got the greatest fix ever. Everybody's going to get faster, a lot less training. Yeah. You know, there's always the quick fix, the magic bullet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so when somebody
every
comes
week.
To you, yeah, when someone comes to you with something that is very unique. I mean, we rode on the Velodrome the other day. You've got sensors in your bike shoes. You got sensors on your quads. You got sensors in your lower back. It looks like something. If you're just an athlete, you're going to get all this information and not know what the heck to do with it. It seems like it's really designed for the coach who can take this information and do something with it.
Yeah, for sure. It is something right now as a tool to be able to be used by somebody who can look at that information and give you the feedback. So, you know, we've seen, you know, in sport and what we do, you know, a lot of data coming at us in different ways. And data, to me, doesn't necessarily change anything. It's nice to collect in some cases, but the data itself doesn't mean anything until it becomes transformed into some useful way. And so then it becomes some bit of useful information within that context of information. The Leomo is providing us really objective information about how we're moving. And again, a good coach and somebody who knows about motion analysis and movement, biomechanics, et cetera, is able to take that information being provided and then give the athlete that they're working with actionable feedback to make a change, to be better, to reduce the potential for injury, et cetera.
Yeah, because what I found interesting, you can spot dead spots in your pedaling. You can notice a difference, the power difference between one leg and another in different parts of the leg. Again, different. So you can take that information. It's one thing that someone using a power meter and you know what type of wattage someone's using, but you don't know how efficient that is.
Correct.
You don't know if, okay, that's great. They're pushing that many watts, but as a triathlete, how does that affect them when they get off the bike and have to run?
Yeah, the integration of what we're seeing. So we get, you know, with the Leomo, they're pairing to, you know, your typical sensors that you may be used to using, whether it's the GPS that's in the Type R head unit or
right.
for speed, power cadence, heart rate, all mm-hmm. of those Amp Plus sensors will also pair to it. So what you're used to seeing is there, but then you get this entirely new dimension of how you're moving. And that's what's really important in terms of preventing injury and optimizing your performance, because, you know, we have repetitive motions in our sport and triathlon and swimming and cycling and running. And especially with the bike, we're somewhat constrained, right? We sit on a saddle, our, you know, feet are attached to the pedals with clipless pedals, and we can hold on to the bars, you know, maybe a couple different places, but there's a lot of repetition without a lot of freedom of movement in some ways. And so the potential to improve your performance by looking at what's going on with asymmetries there and inefficiencies or ineffective movement patterns is actually really, really important, and great that we're doing this not just in a lab, not just sitting there stationary on a trainer, but while you're actually riding.
So how have you used this with some of your elite athletes? I mean, you work with, like you said, you've been work with the Olympic team for the last two Olympics. How have you made use of this?
So what we're doing is putting the Type R on and first gathering some baseline information. You mm-hmm. want to see how a rider pedals, what their mechanics look like with respect to these motions that are being analyzed and evaluated. And we're actually picking up some things that, again, the eye, that we just can't see. And, and get this objective measurement, real-time, left and right, asymmetries, and it is helping us in one way address then how they move and look at actually if we see a restricted range of motion in their ankle. We can see, we can ask, you know, what's been going on? Are there any injuries that they're dealing with or even just soreness? Going all the way to then changing some of the exercises they do off the bike. You know, what kind of strength training exercises we'll prescribe to them to improve that strength and reduce those deficits, and even matching up, you know, I've had this recently, athletes getting a new bike for the season, and they've had a bike that they've been riding for, you know, a year at this point, and they're comfortable and everything's dialed in, and they get on the new bike and they're saying it just doesn't feel right. And with, you know, a standard, you know, just a measuring tape, we're measuring everything up and it seems within a couple millimeters everything's right, but we put them on and we see different range of motion during the pedaling. And so we can make changes to where those bike position are based on that objective movement
that's
captured from the Type R, and dial in that bike just a little bit better so we get them in the same range of motion for their ankles, for their knees, as they're used to doing.
So Jamie Whitmore, 37-time Xterra champion, world champion, I think 6 or 7 national championships as an Xterra athlete. She ends up having a tumor, a cancerous tumor wrapped around her sciatic nerve. They have to cut that, and she loses the ability to run.
Mm-hmm.
As an athlete, because I'm assuming you work with her as a Xterra athlete, and we're talking the ultimate transformation, because then she can't run anymore. She obviously can ride the bike and ends up winning a gold and a silver in the Paralympics. How did you have to change the way you trained Jamie, knowing the limitations that she had on that with that one leg?
Yeah, so there's, you know, a few things. And with Jamie, the other interesting part, too, she went from, you know, again, a mountain bike focus. And, of course, she rode a road bike in training, but then adding track cycling.
Right.
A whole other type of cycling effort and demand and duration of races, you know, right? Xterra races, you know, 2 to 3 hours generally. And so, sorry, my wife just walked in and did the thing. It's kind of like from the YouTube. She strutted in with her elbows out. It was awesome. So she had to change her kind of physiology and preparation, but she has this altered mechanics. She has a brace on her left leg because her ankle, she can't control that degree of flexion and extension. So it is locked out there. And so there are big changes to Jamie's fit and position on her bikes because of that asymmetry. And just before the UCI Track Cycling World Champs out in L.A. 2 weeks ago, I was out there and was able to put the Type R on Jamie, and we just went out for a ride on the road just because I wanted to see what that pedaling actually looked like with the Type R motion analysis. And really indicated what was going on. Of course, the differences between ankle range, but I saw some differences also in leg range, which will lead me to start making some changes to what we do on her road bike position. I wasn't going to make those changes, 2 days before a world championship.
Right.
3 days before a world championship, which she did win her then 10th and 11th paracycling world championships there in L.A. But I didn't want to make it a change right then, the old coach's rule, right?
So, of course.
Don't do anything new right before the race.
So in some, if you have athletes who have injuries and have to change things. I mean, this is probably one of the more radical ones, where you go from being the very pinnacle of your sport, winning everything. And just, she was, 31, 32 years old when basically her career was over. And then she had to reinvent herself. And you were there to help her do that. Well, one, that has to be incredibly satisfying to be there at the, to know at the Paralympics she's, getting a silver and a gold. And as a little girl, she always wanted to be on the top of the podium at the Olympics. And here she is at the age of 40 on the top of the podium, listening to her anthem and watching the flag go up. Just the sort of looking at the athlete before and then what you had to work with. You're not turning things around overnight. You've got to, there's
exactly.
a process there that you know there's a process, but we both know Jamie. Jamie's like, I want it yesterday, right? So how hard was that to say, Jamie, this is a process. You got to trust in it. Your body is so different, but we're going to get there.
Yeah, I think some of the hard part, even from the very beginning, when she started going down this path, even in 2012, she won the national championships, but wasn't selected for the 2012 Paralympics.
Yes.
And again, that was it was a bit of a downer for her at the time. But when I talked to her, when that happened, it's like, listen, this experience is what's going to help you in 2016. And again, she didn't want to necessarily hear it right then, but it allowed her to then realize like she had to do a lot of things better and differently to really be at her now best for 2016 and beyond. And so there were a couple years literally that we were able to retool what she did and be able to learn and make some mistakes. That's part of, training, racing and coaching that, if we can avoid some of the big mistakes, great. But there is going to be a little bit of trial and error. At this point, with some of the information that we're able to get from devices like the Leomo and using, some of the other tracking tools and pieces of information, we may have a little bit less error, but we are still, having to do some experimentation. And sometimes that experimentation we're doing in training and getting some objective measures so we don't make a mistake in the race. We learn something in training. We apply that then in the next race so that we don't have to go and hope at the next race that we did something right. We can test it in training. And that's something that we did a lot in the 4 years, basically leading into Rio.
So how much, as a coach, in this age of Strava, where everybody knows what everybody is doing, back in the day, I'd be the type of guy to tell you, Neil, I went for a 40-mile ride, and I averaged 23 miles an hour, and you would have no clue because I'm just sort of making stuff up. Now, you know exactly what each athlete is doing, and you've got these files. And how different is coaching now compared to the way it used to be?
It's significantly different, just dramatically. I mean, I started in the sport. I did my first triathlon in 1989.
Yep.
So I've been around. I was.
You were a pro. Come on now.
And I did got to that level by hopefully being smarter in some ways with my training. And so for me, there was always some application of the information that was available, whether it be research, whether it be the practices of other coaches and athletes, even in the individual sports and things that would kind of transfer across, and even from completely different sports, learning from, ice hockey, different things. I mean, you can learn a lot by looking outside of what you think is most directly applicable. But in this day and age, something I get automatic, emails when an athlete uploads a file. And often what happens is they get, they just have it set up on their Wi-Fi. They walk in their house and that file gets to me straight away. I get a notification. I get an email. I look at what they did. The most important thing, though, is not for that athlete to upload the file. I tell them it's most important for you to add your comments of how you felt doing that. So the file itself gives me the objective what occurred,
mm-hmm.
but their comments give me the color. So the black and white structure of what happened is there in the file. The power speed, GPS, cadence, whatever, muscle oxygen, all of that tells me what they just did in a black and white, just structural level. But the comment is, for me as a coach, the most important part of synthesizing how that felt, what that was, what that, you know, training was for them as a challenge or not. In some cases, I have, you know, I would think a given workout is quite difficult, and they go out and do it, and they say, you know, that was easy today. You know, another day I anticipate a given workout to be hopefully not challenging, and their comment shows that they were really straining. And so it's that comment that comes along with that information that then allows me to guide and adjust the following workouts, either maybe later that day or in the coming days, and tweak and change what's going on based on their feedback. Because as an athlete, it's really difficult to be objective with your own training. Everyone has a heavily vested interest. You know, with our elite professionals, that those folks, I mean, this is their job. Their
right.
performance
yeah.
at the next race dictates their career in many cases. And so it's a pretty brutally honest, you know, we need to know where we're at and be clear with that. But the athlete often, again, in that a little bit pressurized situation, doesn't make the best decisions on their own. And so that's what the best coaches are able to do is take the feedback that they're being given and the objective information and synthesize that and able to be then objective in that guidance and be able to adapt and adjust what the plans are based on what is actually going on, not just what you want to go on.
So you, like you said, you raced triathlon and raced, I think, 2000, mm-hmm. 2003, and Xterra, winter triathlons, all that type of stuff. What did you
yep.
take from your racing and training? And when did you decide that, you know what, I think I could be a good coach?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So going way
yeah.
back in, it would have been about 1990,
uh-huh.
Did a cross-country road trip with my parents. We had a Volkswagen van, and me and my younger sister and my parents, we drove literally around the country. And one of our stops, I grew up in Pennsylvania, in Hershey,
yeah.
Pennsylvania.
Oh, did you really?
Yep. That's
wow, the home of the chocolate.
Absolutely. And also we had I'll say Tour de Trump, but also the race, as it was called, Tour DuPont,
yeah.
coming in and out of Hershey. So that was some of my first exposure to the professional endurance sport world, which was pretty awesome. So I got to see it, way back then. But we we stopped in Colorado Springs at the Olympic Training Center there and did the tour, and actually was fortunate to be able to go back into the sport performance area. And actually somebody who was working there, one of the biomechanists, gave me basically a personal tour for an hour of what was going on in the sport performance between the biomechanics,
wow.
the physiology, sports psychology. And then and there at age 16, I was like, I want to be involved in sports science.
Wow. So you knew right then.
Yeah. I'm, again, one of those rare folks that kind of knew really what they wanted to do. And throughout, you know, I was, when I went to school then at Penn State University,
uh-huh.
which is where I did my undergraduate, I was part of the Penn State Triathlon Club team. I actually tried to walk on the track and field team. I was a decathlete, pole vault, javelin, discus
really?
were my specialty events, but I'm 5'9", and so the high hurdles and high jump, I really lost a lot of points in a decathlon. And our head coach, Harry Groves at Penn State at the time, was one of the Olympic team coaches, and I was just so far down on the totem pole that, you know, it was a decision after talking with Harry over a weekend, after doing an Olympic developmental decathlon there at Penn State in the summer of, 92, sorry.
Yeah.
That I was deciding what I wanted to do in terms of my future in sport, and I was out riding mountain bike, and I was thinking about it. I was like, okay, in 5 years after I graduate, on a Saturday afternoon, what would I do? I wouldn't go out and be able to just throw javelin for fun on Saturday afternoon, or go out and set up a bunch of high hurdles and, you know, go run hurdles on a Sunday.
Yeah.
But I was out on my mountain bike. I'm like, I can go for a mountain bike ride like this. I could go out, ride the road bike. I could go swim. I can do triathlon. And I was like, you know what? Triathlon is something that I can do as a lifestyle far beyond the end of my, you know, collegiate, you know, career as a as an athlete in some way. And so I switched gears then and ended up joining the triathlon club team, which I think we had, I think when I first started, there were maybe 8 members, and I was eventually elected the president of the team. And as the president, it was kind of like a pseudo coach. There really weren't triathlon coaches in the early 90s, you know, other than, you know, you guys. There were a few folks who were kind of, you know, figuring it out and telling others how to do it. And I was trying to do the same, try to figure it out and help the other collegiate kids. But we had 40 kids on the Penn State team by the time I left.
That's so cool. And so when you decided, when you're riding your mountain bike going, you know, I think I'm going to, triathlon will be a lifestyle sport, something like that. Had you done a triathlon up that point?
Yep. I had done in high school at age 15, my first triathlon. And I did a couple during the summer, even a Bud Light
USTS. Oh, USTS?
Race.
Wow.
Yep. Yep, my senior year, right before school started in August, in military base. Can't think of the name of it, but that was, you know, something that I had done a little bit of, and I enjoyed it, and it was something that then I just refocused on, and you know, all the way through, I then volunteered with First National Teams for USA Triathlon in 1996. Came out to Colorado Springs on my own dime and helped out George Dahlem, who was the USD coach at the time, and spent a couple weeks there, actually. And I visited Boulder at the end of that because the Boulder Peak Triathlon just happened to be being raced that weekend. So I did the Boulder Peak Triathlon in 96 when I was out here on kind of a working vacation, and I ended up moving out in April of 1997. And I've been here, you know, ever since here in Boulder.
So at that point, triathlon was going to be in the Olympics for the first time in 2000 in Sydney, but they had changed the sport. The sport had gone from, you know, to get in because they were concerned after one of the world championship races, I think it was actually back in 88 or so, and all of a sudden you had this huge pack of guys on the bike, and you know, it was like, how do we disqualify these guys? Wetsuits had made it so everybody was swimming about the same. And people were coming out of the water together. You really couldn't enforce the drafting. So then it became draft legal in the sport of triathlon. I mean, you were right there sort of at the epicenter when all this was happening. A lot of the athletes were very angry about it. But the reality was that they weren't going to leave it up to judges to decide if someone was a winner of a gold medal at the Olympics. They had enough of that with figure skating and the rest of that. What were your thoughts, and how did that change the coaching aspect of it? Because then it becomes more of the bike ride is not a steady state ride. It's a crit.
Correct. So, you know, for me, there was a lot of we'll call it discussion back then. And,
yes.
You know, there was hatred of the draft legal aspect of triathlon at the time. The purest, the original, you know, a lot of folks were saying that is not the same sport. And well, it is. It was a totally different change. Different isn't worse. It's just different.
Right.
And there still remains a level of the sport that is non-draft with Ironman at 70.3 and unfortunately not enough non-draft Olympic or international distance races, in my opinion,
this
point. But there still are some. The opportunity is absolutely still there to be able to race non-draft. And it never, you know, it didn't break the sport in any terrible way. And in fact, I think it has led to really different branches. And that
Absolutely.
Way we have more opportunity for more different types of athletes, because there are plenty of very, very, very accomplished draft legal triathletes who really actually never did an Ironman and probably never would, you know, just based on their physiology, where they're best at. And they can have an entire career just like the best Ironman athletes. Most of them will not have ever been able to have gone to the Olympics because they just didn't have that pure speed or tactical or explosive power necessary on the bike. And so I think it's a great thing to have these different branches. It's like track and field. I mean, you've got Usain Bolt who can do, you know, 100 meters, 200 meters And then you have, you know, your marathon runners.
Exactly.
You have somebody totally different. And it's okay to have people with different specialties within the same umbrella of the sport. Well, I think it just makes the pie bigger. It didn't take the pie away from anyone in my viewpoint. And so even way back then, I was actually doing some bike racing. And so I really appreciated that application of the tactical aspect.
Yep.
Even though I was, you know, as an athlete myself,
you're a purist.
I'm for sure a non-draft.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a swim biker and I hang on for dear life on the run. So I did a couple ITU races as an elite and, you know, draft legal races. And definitely they were some of my worst finishes as a professional athlete, but it was still an experience for me to do those and to, you know, go for that challenge and see how well I could do with it, and had some, you know, really cool experiences in doing those races, but it just wasn't my strength or forte, and that's okay.
What's interesting is I remember back in those days, it was a moral issue. It really was.
Yeah.
I mean, for guys
yeah.
like myself who were, you know, the first time a draft pack came by me in Kona at the Ironman, I was mortified. Yeah. I was like, who would ever sit behind somebody? It was like it said something about your character if you were willing to sit behind somebody's wheel. So for a long time, and I loved the fact that, hey, from a television perspective, and actually my friend Lisa Lax produced that first ever Olympic triathlon in 2000 in Sydney, and their whole idea was, we want to do a travelogue on the city of city of Sydney. We want to show the Opera House. We want to show the bridge. We want to show Sydney Harbor. And we're going to use a sport that's incredibly popular in this country, triathlon.
Yeah.
And the crowds were huge. They opened the games with it. And more importantly, when you're watching the Ironman, usually when you go to commercial, sometime during a marathon, some guy's got a 10-minute lead. Well, now you go to commercial and there's 15 people off the bike together. And it became great television. To me, that's what made the
Absolutely.
Olympics and made triathlon work so well together. You saw it the same way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was in a hotel out at, I think, Half Moon Bay for an Xterra race, and we were watching the Olympic triathlon live. You know, several other elite pro triathletes out there in our hotel the night before the race, just watching, and just we were so jazzed to see that. And there were a couple people that we knew, you know, that we had trained with maybe here and there that were racing, but to see it on that screen was huge.
Yeah.
And that was phenomenal. And so again, I think it only makes the pie bigger to have non-draft racing, to have draft legal, to have ITU format, to have even the new stuff like the Super League. You know, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was just like, man, I wonder what's going on. And I pulled it up and I watched for a little while in the middle of the night.
Yep.
And it was exciting. I'm excited to see more of that, and the MLTS series going on here. You know, for me, again, just make the pie bigger. Give
variety.
More athletes more opportunities. More racing is better for everyone. And honestly, for the average person, I think having that short race is something that does keep that sustainable lifestyle.
It's hard to
do an Ironman every year if you have kids and you work and this and that. Like, that's a challenge.
Well, so your breakdown in terms of the athletes you coach now, and actually, I don't want to short shift. We went from being a pro and then moved into the coaching side.
The coaching realm. Yep.
And you started coaching in 90. You started Apex in 99.
Yep.
And over time, and when you win something like the Doc Councilman Coach of the Year, right, by USOC.
Mm-hmm.
That goes beyond being a cycling coach. That goes beyond being a triathlon coach. Anybody who knows coaching and they hear the name Doc Councilman, that is like the greatest coach of all time from Indiana, the swim coach.
Yep.
Winning that to me is sort of like drop the microphone time. That you sort of go, okay, I'm doing the right stuff. How important was that to you, and what did that mean to your career?
Yeah, that honestly is truly a career highlight as a professional working career. So as a coach, I've always taken that view of, we want to be incorporating the science that's out there with what we do. So it's that combination of, you know, again, USA Triathlon has the art and science. I think the practical and the science application in working with athletes to help them be better, be faster, do what they do better, healthier, more sustainably. And so the Doc Councilman Award, you know, part of that comes from the fortune that I had in working at the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine for 12 years. So, you know, here in Boulder, Andy Pruitt founded Boulder Center for Sports Medicine in 1998. I was in graduate school at CU Boulder at the time, so I moved to Boulder in 97 for graduate school, doing my master's degree. And my study was actually looking at the effects of strength training on endurance performance using triathlon as our model so that we could look between swimming, cycling, and running. And if you think about that, that's actually a really big topic and probably more of a PhD project than a master's project, which ultimately I did have to thin down some of that just to do the master's because I was kind of in that period of choice between racing, working, family, and PhD, et cetera. And so I kind of shifted down gear to just do the master's, and I had applied, though, to work at Boulder Center for Sports Medicine when they first opened up, even just to do an internship. And Andy Pruitt said, thanks very much for your interest, but we don't take interns. We got to do work. So I was like, okay. And then after I graduated, there was a position that opened up. I was as a biomechanics tech at the center, helping out with bike fitting, and I applied, and Andy said, listen, you're overqualified. And at the time, I was like, but I'm underemployed.
You know,
I was,
exactly, yeah.
I was racing as an elite triathlete, but, you know, at my level, I wasn't able to make a full living. So I did take a job. I was the manager of the IBM Boulder Fitness Center in Boulder. And then about a year into that, where I was still racing and working full-time, the job as the director of the sports science department came up, and I applied, and the third time I was in, finally. Andy hired me, and for 12 years I spent working as the director of the sports science department. So we had a biomechanics lab, a physiology lab, sports nutrition, and I brought coaching into the fold at Boulder Center for Sports Medicine. They never really had the actual coaching aspect of things. And so in working there was, you know, a mix of things and integrating the different technologies and the sports sciences to help athletes be better. And the Doc Council, Doc Councilman Award is really the application of sports science in coaching. And through some of the work that I did and looking at indirect calorimetry and trying to understand energy expenditure and especially applied to long distance athletes like triathletes getting ready for an Ironman and how to fuel appropriately, as well as some of the work that I was doing with our U.S. track cycling team that won a silver medal at the 2011 World Championships, and then went on to Olympic silver at 2012 Olympic Games, and again this past year silver and a World Championship last year. The USOC, you know, selected me to you know, for that award.
Yeah.
And Doc Councilman, he was Mark Spitz's coach.
Yep.
He was also a PhD exercise physiologist. And literally to have my name, you know, in the same sentence with Doc Councilman to me is honestly an absolute career highlight. But I'm not going to drop the mic and walk out. There's still plenty more work to be done, plenty more athletes to help. And you know, as I move forward, to help educate more coaches, too.
In
these ways, because the impact then can be spread to more and more athletes. And so that's something that I'm excited for.
What's always concerned me when it comes to coaching is I see all the technology, all the science, you and your team and so many of the other coaches out there, they take information, they create training programs. The whole key is to keep athletes healthy. I see a lot of high school and college runners, and the coaches are basically someone who volunteers. And you've got these kids running 60, 70, 80 miles a week, and they break down, right? Especially a lot of the gals get stress fractures. And a number of people I've interviewed who, I burned out in college because all of a sudden I went from 30 miles a week to 80 miles a week, got stress fractures, and didn't get back into the sport until 10 years later. And I'm going, wow.
That's a broken system.
Don't you think? I mean, am I wrong on that? It just seems that I look at someone like a Gwen Jorgensen, and Gwen ran at Wisconsin. She was 3,000-meter Big Ten champion, and she is running faster now. I had Bobby McGee on talking about this. She's running faster now on less mileage because she does a lot of her intensity on the bike and in the pool. And to me, that message is so simple to transfer back to high school and college coaches, so you don't, all these kids who are getting injured, that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, no, it's unfortunate the way our systems tend to be set up that our developing athletes, and again, it's not just the sport of triathlon. You can go to Little League, you can go to soccer.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Know, you can go across the board. And the athletes that need the most effective and safe instruction and guidance are being given that instruction and guidance by the least educated and least knowledgeable information.
That is a great point.
People, unfortunately.
You're right.
And that's just a structural how things are set up. If you go and look at some of the European systems, they have that club system in place where you actually have a lot of higher level coaches working with the younger athletes. So that the focus can be on development, and you also have some of the older athletes from the community that are also there to support, you know, equipment and things like that. That it doesn't just have to be the burden on the family. That there's a shared community aspect as well. And so I think we, as a country, could do a lot better by incorporating and changing some of our models. And reintroducing that kind of club concept, not just a club of all, you know, 30, 40, 50-year-old, you know, athletes getting together and training, but having that club working with some of the youth programs in the area, with the schools, and being able to provide that instruction. I think, you know, the NCAA, you know, we now have some women's triathlon within that NC2A umbrella.
Yep.
And I think there's definitely clear pluses to that. There may be some minuses along the way, but being able to have good coaches working with good programs at the collegiate level is great. And I think, again, that makes the pie only bigger. Hopefully we can, you know, get it going, both guys and girls, with, you know, men and women for NC2A as we move forward. But continue to provide other community and post-collegiate, because we do have a lot of athletes that will come in post a collegiate career. You know, Gwen as a runner, I was a swimmer at Iowa. There's, you know, you can go down the list.
And
a host of athletes that, you know, came to the sport of triathlon after a single sport career and collegiate education, which is, I think, again, a good model, you know, to help our athletes have an education. Because a career in the sport of triathlon, some folks are fortunate to be able to exclusively do that and have the right contacts and opportunities after their racing career to then work within, you know, the industry in some way. More often than not, though, we're going to need something to fall back on, some level of education. And so I think being able to tie those together is still important, and have those opportunities for individuals who come to the sport later, that we don't necessarily need, you know, that not every 10 and under Iron Kids, you know, triathlete is going to continue on later on, and that's okay. And we're going to have great athletes that come in as 20-some-year-olds, mid-20s in some cases. And that's good. I think we want to keep those doors open, regardless of when people come to us.
So in terms of the
sport,
in terms of the breakdown with Apex Coaching, how much is it the elite side? You've been a coach as part of two Olympic teams and working with world-class triathletes.
Yeah.
And how much of it is age group athletes?
Yeah, so personally, my coaching is more than 80% elites.
Okay.
About 90% elites of who I work with are actual professional cyclists and professional triathletes. I do have a few age group athletes, including, you know, Ellen Hart, who's had some phenomenal success.
Oh, yeah.
Basically every distance from the U.S. and the world. And so I have a couple age group athletes that I work with, and a couple others that are nowhere near as accomplished as say somebody like Ellen. I have other coaches though within Apex. I've got six other coaches, and for the most part, they focus more on the age group population. So they are at least, you know, they're 80-90% age group and amateur athletes, compared to me being that kind of switched opposite. I would say it is a little more intense to be working with elite and professional athletes, and especially, you know, I have that a bit of a mix between even ITU athletes and non-draft athletes and track cyclists and road cyclists and, you know, cyclocross, and across the mix, even within the different, you know, between cycling and triathlon disciplines. It, to me, it keeps it interesting and fun, and I've fortunately had a fair amount of experience across these different sports to understand them well enough to be able to be an effective coach.
So you, in February 2015, Rowan Dennis goes off and breaks the 1 hour record, right?
Yeah, hour record. Yep.
52.491 K in an hour UCI Correct. Record. And then Evelyn Stevens does that in February of 2016, 47.98 K. Training for that, something that's that mm-hmm. intense. How do you have to change their training to get ready for something like that?
Yeah, the big thing about the hour, there's a physical component and there's a psychological component.
Yes.
And in both cases, both of those athletes are incredibly mentally tough and resilient, driven, et cetera. And so you can't have one or the other. You need both to be tuned well to execute that. It's a really cool challenge from kind of the objective sports science side of things. When I look at that, you know, you can break it down and say it's kind of simple. You have a bike with one gear that you start on the line, the clock starts, and you have 60 minutes to go as far as you can. Simple isn't easy, though. The integration between the aerodynamics, the power production, the pacing, even your nutrition, et cetera, before it begins, because you don't stop and take a drink. There's no water bottle on the bike. You can't hand up a water bottle. It's not allowed. All the nutrition, everything that must be dialed in before they start is important. And then that psychology of having them have a plan to get through literally every minute of that while optimizing their output is an incredible challenge. But when it's done right, and when an athlete sets a record like that, man, it's an incredible high. But I can tell you, as a coach, being there on the track, and there's only one person allowed trackside, the coach, providing some level of feedback as they go by, those 3,600 seconds are some of the most intense 3,600 seconds that I've spent. The attention and focus required is incredible. And it's intense, and it's draining, literally, just for me standing there giving them feedback and guiding them on. At the end of that, I feel just I'm shot.
I bet.
You know, I'm mentally exhausted. Again, pressure and expectation and all those things aside, it's still an intense endeavor of paying attention to something at that degree for that period of time. Literally, I had at most 6 or 7 seconds between taking a measurement and giving feedback at any one point. If I drift off for 3 or 4 seconds, I may mess up and not give them the feedback that they're relying on. And I'm asking them to do the most work that they can possibly do. So it is my responsibility to give them absolutely 100% of my attention and to help them.
What's interesting about that, when you have an athlete doing something like the Ironman, basically, when the cannon goes off, your work is done. You might be on the course somewhere, you know, drinking a latte and, okay, good job, way to go. But you are intimately involved.
You might literally see them a total of 60 seconds.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
And this is like the opposite, that for all 3,600 seconds, you are right there with them.
Yeah, you are on. You are as into it as they are and have to be. And I always think about that in terms of an hour. How many times have we been on a workout and you're going, okay, I'm not halfway done yet, and I'm done. You're going, I still got another thing. So mentally, you can beat yourself up and go, I'm 28 minutes in, and I got to do this again? There's no way. So in your training, how much of it is the mental side?
Yeah, so with Evie last year, because the hour was new, and she had ridden on the track a little bit. We had used some of our track, some of the U.S. team track camps in previous years. So she was familiar with the track, and she's a time trialist. But doing a time trial on the track was a new thing. So we talked about it at the World Championships in 2015. September of 2015 was the first idea about it. And we started putting some ideas together and fortunately had, you know, great cooperation from the team and sponsors. And so in November of 2015, I had gotten a bike from Specialized and disc wheels from Zip. And, you know, we put everything together and we did a trial with absolutely telling nobody about it, really, other than the minimum that we needed to down in Colorado Springs to go into the velodrome, and do just an hour at an effort that I knew that she could sustain. It was, again, in a kind of postseason. Mm-hmm. She had just started training a couple weeks earlier for the 2016, getting ready for the 2016 season. But it was just for her to understand and feel what an hour of relatively hard but not maximal effort was like on the track, to see if we should even go forward with it, as well as to see if she could execute the pacing and just hold this what we knew would be a moderately hard but not maximal effort, and see whether the project went forward or not. And she did that and ended up riding, I think it was very close to 45K, 44K change.
Wow. Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this is, you know, for me on certain sides, it was definitely doable. But again, it was her psychology and whether she was totally up for the challenge, which she definitely was. Interestingly for her confidence, she did basically two more one-hour sustained efforts, one of them being on an outdoor track out in San Francisco, on her TT bike, not on a track bike, but on a TT bike as a bit of a test out there and trial and see where her fitness was. And again, just to get familiar with that effort again. And then she did one more stationary on a trainer, 1 hour at a set power, goal, cadence, et cetera, in one gear. And with that one, I made a little video of riding a lap of the track at our goal speed at 48 kilometers per hour. So she just had that playing on a loop sitting in front of her, just
wow,
totally concentrating,
yeah,
pushing that effort and just seeing the same thing over and over and over for an hour.
God.
And Rowan had done something similar in that way, had a video from a different track, from a 250 meter track at the pace that he was shooting for, you know, 52-53k an hour, and get some of that visualization and psychological preparation.
Man, that's amazing stuff. And I remember Gwen talking about wearing the virtual reality goggles and going and basically watching that real course over and over and over again. What was the experience?
It's an application, exactly. Application of that preparation from the psychological perspective, which I'd say a lot of our amateur athletes don't do as well as our professionals do.
Yeah. Your first Olympic experience, was that 2012?
2008 with Taylor Finney.
Oh, 18-year-old. Right.
Yeah.
So when you go to, and that was, I remember that whole thing with Taylor.
Yeah, that was a wild ride.
That was a wild ride, because basically I remember him coming to the velodrome with Roger Young and you know, with Connie. And jumping on a velodrome, I think he broke the velodrome record the first time he rode the thing.
Exactly. And Rogers told Connie, he's like, there's your national champion.
Yeah.
Which was happening about a month later. And Connie's like, well, do you mean like junior, U23? And Rogers' like, no, that's going to be your elite national champion.
And this is a kid who's obviously his dad was the cash register, who was the best American cyclist, especially the sprinter. And then his mom was an 84 Olympic gold medalist, who's also in like 800 Hall of Fames for speed skating and rowing and everything. And he didn't really
champion on the track in the 3K individual pursuit.
Exactly. And and he really didn't get into the whole cycling side till what, he was 16 or so?
Yeah. Yep.
So when all of a sudden, so is that when you started working with him, when he got on the track?
Before that. So I started coaching him. He did a local race series here in Boulder. It was the Stasio Criteriums, and they had a junior race and then a Cat 4 race. And he won. There were four weekends in a row of races.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. He won his field in every single one of those. And it was just maybe a month or two later that I sat down with Connie and Davis, and we talked about it. And because Connie has a master's degree in exercise physiology, she was actually the junior national team coach for USA Cycling way back with Dee Barry.
Right. Yeah.
You know, Lance and everyone back then. So she knew what to do as a coach, but she wanted to be a parent, not his coach.
Right.
And so they asked if I would be willing to coach him. And, you know, when they asked me that, you know, it's like, geez, that is a lot of pressure and expectation coming along with a, you know, young kid like that.
Yeah.
You know, every coach in the world is going to tell me that they know what to do better and different and this and that. But I had a great relationship with Connie and Davis. I had helped with some of their cycling camps, and they knew and trusted me as well. And so, you know, I started coaching from the time he was 16, and you know, again, he accomplished some phenomenal things. The track really happened after he won the Junior TT World Championships in 2007, which literally he was a first-year junior when he went down to Aguascalientes.
Yep.
And he was in good form, but he didn't even win the U.S. National Championship in the time trial. He was second at U.S. Nationals. At World Championships, literally just, you know, a few weeks later, he was there, we thought, for the experience, so that in 2008, then that he could really go for it. Taylor has, he was going full gas that year, and he ended up winning. He beat yes. Michael Kwiatkowski, who, you know, if you're into road cycling, you know now that he's been road world champion and a pretty phenomenal racer himself. But Taylor won that Junior World Championship in I think it was August then of 2007, and Connie Davis and I, we talked and looked at things, and there was a super outside chance of him being able to qualify for the Olympics in the individual pursuit if a whole series of events happened one after another successfully. And the first thing being just getting on the track, and he was interested.
Right.
And then he was interested and he liked it, then going to U.S. Nationals. If he did well at Nationals, then he could go to the first World Cups, which were in Sydney.
Yep.
One weekend in November, followed then by beginning of December in Beijing the week after, which was the Olympic test event. If he was scoring points at those two, then there was a World Cup in Los Angeles in January of 2008, followed by a final World Cup in Copenhagen, and then the World Championships in Manchester in March, followed then by the potential for the Olympic Games in August of 2008 as an 18-year-old. He had just turned 18 yep. 6 weeks or 5 weeks before the Olympics, so it was possible. It was like literally holding a needle in your left arm far away from you, holding a thread in your right hand, again, away from your body, closing your eyes, and just guiding that thread through the needle in one fell swoop, one time, no errors, and you can make it.
Well, yeah, because even the amount of travel... I just remember the amount of travel that he had to do. Just to, by the time he got to the Olympics, he had to be pretty fried.
It was a wild, long, big, intense ride. And every single one of those steps happened. I'm actually looking at my old T-shirt that we printed up. World Tour, 372-day World Tour. The distance, total air miles, I think, ended up being like 148,000 air 80,000 miles flown, 10,000 miles ridden, et cetera, on this Taylor Finney USA Pursuit of Beijing T-shirt, which I keep. It was an incredible ride. And again, in the middle of that ride, at the World Championship. So, I mean, Taylor, at that first World Cup, I happened to be going out there with Trish Downing. She was doing Ironman Western Australia.
Which, that's right. You know, yeah, Trish one Downing. Of our wheelchair athletes.
Yep, so she's a hand cyclist,
yep.
And she was trying to complete an Ironman within the time limit.
Yes.
And, you know, she had done some other events in Western Australia. It happened to be a fast course for the bike, which has always been the most
the
difficult
problem.
Part for,
yeah.
for a female hand cyclist in an Ironman. And I had already booked my ticket months in advance before Taylor even rode the track for the first time, which I happened to be flying into Sydney and connecting to go out then to Perth on the exact same day when Taylor was doing his first World Cup. And so I landed in Sydney. I took a cab out to the Bankstown Velodrome. I got there less than an hour before Taylor raced. I was able to, you know, talk him through things, and Connie was there. And Taylor had a phenomenal ride, which I had to actually get back in a cab before everyone was done, because there were, I think, you know, 30-some, almost 40 guys doing the individual pursuit, because it was, you know, one of the Olympic events still, and everyone still had an opportunity at that point to qualify if they were fast enough. And I got in the cab, and I had to get on my plane to Perth, and I didn't even know the end result until I landed in Perth, you know, 4 or 5 hours later, that he ended up finishing ninth.
Wow.
And I got all his split times, and there were a couple corrections that we could make in terms of his pacing strategy. The week later was in Beijing, and he ended up fourth at that World Cup.
Yeah,
so everything was set in motion, and he said after that, he said, "I'm winning in L.A."
Yes, which he did.
Which he did. Trish, on the other hand, she had the opposite.
Yes.
She went out to Western Australia. She had a double flat.
Yeah.
As a hand cyclist, one flat is terrible. Two flats is absolutely catastrophic.
Yes.
He had to ride it to an aid station, have somebody help change it, and literally it blew the chances of finishing that race under the time limit.
Yeah, the problem with a hand cyclist is there's no window, right? There's no,
nope.
You got to finish by 5:30 in the afternoon, whatever it happens to be, and if you lose a minute, 2 minutes, you're done, and that's what's so tough.
Yeah, so as a coach, again, riding this incredible high with Taylor and an incredible low with with Trish, and not long after that then was when everything was going on with Jamie.
So right.
Jamie, and this was 2007 in the diagnosis. And Jamie was in for her second major surgery in March, literally when I was at the World Championships with Taylor, when he was right on the cusp of qualifying. He ended up finishing second in the World Cup standings. He missed winning an Olympic spot by finishing second. He was at the World Champs, and he had to finish in a certain place, basically in the top eight, to still have that chance alive to go to Beijing. And fortunately, he finished seventh, and I was there on the phone with Courtney while Jamie's on the table for, I think, a 10-plus hour surgery, which was kind of touch and go. You know, it was not good.
Yeah,
she almost lost her life. Everyone there is on a high, and then I'm talking with Courtney, you know, from Manchester, from the inside of that velodrome, and that's an incredible low at the time.
You know what's fascinating about that? You think about it, that year, that 2007 year for you with with Tricia and Taylor and Jamie. I mean, those three things that you're balancing all at the same time with, you know, you've got tragedy and trauma and jubilation. And it's, as a coach, that in a microcosm is what you're all about, right? Is you have to be your therapist sometime, and you have to, okay, it's great, we won this, but let's calm down. We still have a bigger prize here. That's that was probably the ultimate in 2007. That's a book.
That year was absolutely just incredible.
Good.
And so, just like a boat, you got to keep that rudder down.
Love it.
Keep everything moving the right way. Sometimes you pull the sails down, there's too much wind, you just got to hang on for the ride and keep steering it the right direction. And then sometimes you get to put up the sails and let it roll.
And seeing Taylor at that Olympics in 2008, that had to be a high point.
Absolutely. I mean, everything you get there, and that whole journey was incredible. And, you know, there were some things that, like that Olympic, his races, he ended up finishing, you know, seventh as an 18-year-old, which was incredible, but there was still, I'd say, some levels of performance that just weren't accessed right there.
Right.
But literally just a couple months later, then Taylor became the youngest individual pursuit world champion in March in 2009 in Poland, and then followed it up a year later, winning his second consecutive world championship as a 19-year-old in Copenhagen in 2010. And so, you know, and he set American records along the way in both the kilo and the 4K pursuit, which, you know, both records still stand. And so, again, sometimes you make investments that don't yield the return right when you want them.
Right.
Flora
yes.
Duffy. I've been working with her. I met her on the plane going from London to Beijing.
Oh, really?
She sat in the seat behind Connie and I, and, you know, we just met and said hello. And, you know, she had a terrible Olympics, right?
Yes.
2008 for her, you know, she got laughed out. She was going into it sick and injured and did not have a great experience in Beijing. She did not finish. She got laughed out on the bike. She quit the sport of triathlon after that. I wasn't in touch with her other than meeting her on that plane, but I got a call in January of 2009, you know, kind of out of the blue. Hi, my name's Flora. I think I met you on a plane going to Beijing. I'm going to school at CU now, and I just want to race bikes. But okay.
Sure.
We can do that.
Yeah.
You know, and so we started off with Flora. You know, I started coaching her and just focusing on cycling. And she basically rediscovered the love of competition with the bike first, and then by choice came back to triathlon. And here we are last year being an unbelievable, you know, three world championships in 1 year.
Yep.
And, you know, the investments, though, of what she learned and what she did in those, you know, even years leading up to 2008 and ever since, is one of those things that you never know when you're going to get rewarded for staying to it and being resilient.
Sometimes you realize you have to walk away to discover that you love it.
Yeah. Right?
You know, that,
yep.
that I'm sort of hoping that happens with Lucas Verzbeekas, the young man that I was representing. And now is he's back in school and, you know, he had broke his back and just lost his.
I remember him coming in and meeting with Andy Pruitt. Because, you know, he had some clear issues that need to be addressed in that.
Yeah.
From that medical perspective. And I hope the same again. Everyone hope he's able to
turn
to
it around.
Find that passion and love for it again.
Exactly. And the problem is in those type of situations, it's gotta come had to come from Flora. It's not something you can say, hey, I love this sport, you should love this sport. Flora had to get her love back for the sport of triathlon before she was able to perform.
Correct. It is that passion and intensity that, you know, just comes from the person that can help drive. Have to drive that.
Love it.
Have to drive it.
Neil, thank you so much for taking so much time. I apologize for taking up your whole morning.
No, it's not a problem. I got 45 minutes and I got to get over to the group workout, so I'm set.
Love it.
Easy.
Love it. Neil Henderson has been a guest again. Apex Coaching Co. CoachingCo.com, correct?
Correct.
Love
company
it.
Company or Colorado. Think of it either way.
Either way.
Coaching Colorado, Apex Coaching Company. .com.
Perfect. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, by ATV Swim Spas. You can check them out at ATVSwimSpas.com. They'll be there at the Ironman 70.3 Oceanside with six-time Ironman champion Dave Scott. Our CAF back-to-back NorCal ride, you can check that out at ChallengedAthletes.org. Check us out on Babbittville.com, on iTunes, and as always, endurance lives here.